I want to welcome everyone for coming to our event, How Blasphemy Laws Silence Speech and Destroy Lives. This is a very important issue when it comes to freedom of speech, to religious liberty, and to the operation of democracy in terms of liberal political systems and how we handle complaints over religious persecution and religious practice. There are a number of countries around the world in which religious liberty is under siege. One of the ways that it has been attacked is through essentially weaponizing blasphemy laws, which are used against all faiths, but very often target minority faiths, people who are already vulnerable within societies where a majority of people have another faith. Blasphemy prosecutions are unique in many ways. In fact, in some cases, there is a presumption of guilt. Judges and courts will not even repeat the words used. We also see very often violence that is associated with this, people who are killed before coming to trial, attorneys who are killed handling such cases. And what we see then is this is an attack, as I mentioned, on many aspects, not just religious liberty for the individual, but brought more broadly within a society, but free speech beyond that, as well as democratic practices. So the question then is what to do about this. I mean, there is some hope. We see at some points people recognize the problem. A couple of days ago in Pakistan, an accusation was made in the city of Peshawar about an alleged blasphemy of Muhammad's name being placed on the sole of a shoe, and people were charged. The shop was closed, but then a fatwa was issued a couple of days later indicating the importance of not making erroneous, not making false blasphemy charges. It noted that all it was a design, that it was not the prophet's name. That there at least someone stepped in religious authority and indicated that this was not a proper charge, because these charges are very often used to essentially destroy lives. But this is one instance and not nearly enough given the problem of these laws. To discuss this issue, we have a very fine panel, very pleased. You can read the names on our website if you want more in the biography on the website. But just very quickly, we have Joelle Fiss, who is a human rights activist and a researcher. As a member of the Geneva Parliament, she has worked now with the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, has written a lot on these issues, co-wrote a study on blasphemy for the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. And she was joined in this by Jocelyn Getkin-Kestenbaum. I might be getting that name wrong, but Jocelyn is not with us, but was co-author, an associate professor at Cardozo Law School. A very good study, one that I have cited and gone to. We have the URL up on our website. I encourage everyone interested in this issue, please get that report. It's a wonderful discussion of a very difficult issue. We also have with us Marvi Sermad from Pakistan. She is a journalist, a political commentator, an activist on human rights, and somebody who's paid a very high personal price. We in the United States can talk about these issues. We live very secure, very protected lives. She has been personally attacked, physically shot at, and she's had her home invaded. And so we see kind of where these laws lead. She is somebody who's paid a very real price standing up for people who are victimized by these laws. While Joelle is going to talk broadly about the issue, Marvi's going to focus on Pakistan, which is perhaps the most problematic state, and an issue that she can discuss, again, the impact on democratic practices as well as individuals. And then we go to Mustafa Akyol. I'm proud to call a colleague of mine here at the Cato Institute. He's a senior fellow with the Center for Global Liberty and Prosperity. He is a journalist from Turkey. He's somebody who has stood up for democracy, and that has been increasingly difficult in Turkey. We're very glad to have him with us, though we wish that Turkey was a more hospitable climate these days. He has also written very elegantly and on issues of liberalism and Islam, a very fine book, Islam Without Extremes, A Muslim Case for Liberty. I think a very important book. It's very easy for Westerners of different faiths to say that Islam should be one thing or another. It's extraordinarily important to have somebody who is a Muslim within the Islamic faith talking about these issues and looking at how one kind of deals with them. And he's also paid a bit of a price. He was arrested by the religious police in Malaysia when he came to speak about his book, and it was not appreciated. Thankfully, he was quickly released. But this, again, shows these kind of issues we're dealing with, that even very responsible, non-blasphemous treatment of these issues, that dealing with these difficult issues can be a problem. Where each of them is going to speak for 8 to 10 minutes, then we'll move to your questions. We'd love to have your questions. You can put them up on Twitter. We're going by hashtag Cato Events, on Facebook, on YouTube, and we will pick from those. And we might not get to all of them. We hope that you will understand that, but we look forward to a very good exchange. So, Joel, would you like to start us off?
Yes, thank you very much, Doug. And I would like to, express my warm thanks to the Cato Institute and Mustafa Akyol in particular for inviting me to this event. It's an honor to speak to you all. As Doug mentioned, this research took 2 years to accomplish. It was the result of a great collaboration between myself and the Human Rights Law Clinic at Cardozo Law School. And nothing would have been possible without my co-author, Jocelyn Getgen, as was mentioned. And of course, nothing would have been possible either without Elizabeth Cassidy and Kirsten Lavery from the US Commission on International Religious Freedom. So thanks to all of this team, because it was really a teamwork. Now, what did we try to do? We really tried to produce a snapshot in time, basically, to capture states across the globe and how they enforce blasphemy laws within their country during a 5-year period between 2014 and 2018. And so we literally examined every single state action across 84 countries where we recorded blasphemy legislation, and we inspected all the different kinds of state agents. So I'm speaking about police officers, security agents, prison officials, prosecutors and judges, basically all state and judicial authorities. And we found a treasure of findings. And unfortunately, I'll only be able to highlight a few of them, but I hope that it will be interesting enough for you to be able to pick up the report and, as Doug very warmly recommended, for you to read. So just some general remarks before getting into the statistics and maybe overwhelming you with a bit of, figures. It's important, first of all, to know that all of these criminal blasphemy cases occur in the context of broader religious freedom violations. So that's very important to acknowledge. You have all sorts of different freedom of religion or belief violations, such as bombings, assaults on places of worship, desecration of religious sites and or symbols, hate crimes against individuals, other types of, assault, hate speech, harassment, verbal attacks, discrimination, etc. And you can't isolate blasphemy-related incidents from these other events in a country, notably, general, broader situations of violation of freedom of belief. Now, another important point is that we noticed during the course of our study that there are different ways to enforce criminal blasphemy laws. Not only the laws themselves, but also through the enforcement of other laws, such as apostasy laws, anti-conversion laws, incitement to religious hatred laws, anti-extremism laws, and even anti-witchcraft laws, we discovered. So basically, these sort of allegations, blasphemy allegations, often are conflated with other forms of allegations as well. And that's important to bear in mind. Another important point that we immediately sort of discovered was that in both cases where states enforce or don't enforce the law, mobs can provoke a lot of violence and threats and injuries and death. And so, for example, I'm just going to give you one example. Some incidents within this study could not even be recorded. I'm thinking about, for example, the attack against the French satirical paper Charlie Hebdo in 2015. Why didn't we record this event, even if it fits the timeline? Because France doesn't have a blasphemy law, okay? So we only recorded, in a rather conservative way, all the events that pertained to a country in which there was an existing blasphemy law during that time frame. So that's an important for you to understand that, you know, this study is just conservative and the tip of the iceberg, and there may be many more incidents that are not necessarily recorded. So what did we find? So we found, first of all, in the 5-year time frame, we found 732 reported incidents. And out of those, in 674 times, the state directly enforced the criminal law itself. And in the other rest of the times, in 58 times, mobs were taking justice into their own hands. Now, what is very interesting is that 81% of all the cases that we recorded were actually identified in 10 states, which means that there is a great amount of concentration of blasphemy cases in 10 specific countries. And that is Pakistan, first of all, Iran, Russia, India, Egypt, Indonesia, Yemen, Bangladesh, Saudi Arabia, and Kuwait. Okay. And within that, actually, Pakistan accounts for over a quarter of all the cases in the world during that 5-year period. Okay. So that is 27% or 184 cases out of all of them. And we also noticed that there were regional patterns. The Asia Pacific and the Middle East regions were the two regions that accounted for 84% of the world's enforcement of all the laws. So that was an important finding. And a huge other finding was that the instances of violence, the incidents of mob activity, violence, threats, with or without state enforcement, took place in nearly 80% of all the incidents in only 4 countries. So the 4 countries where there is a huge concentration of violence are in Pakistan, Bangladesh, Nigeria, and Egypt. Okay. And finally, another phenomenon was that 75% of all reported cases and incidents were found in countries where Islam is the state religion. That's also an important finding. A few words on the phenomenon of mob violence. So it's important to bear in mind that violence can occur when the state enforces the law, but also when the state doesn't enforce the law. And when the state doesn't enforce the law, mobs are stirred and they take justice in their own hands. And the fact that the public officials actually tolerate this means that, you know, they're responsible by omission because they do tolerate this civil unrest. We found scores of incidents. We found 136 incidents in total, and that's a very conservative estimate because we actually excluded all sorts of forms of political protests where blasphemy is often used within the political protests. The reason why we didn't include them is because sometimes there was blasphemy was invoked, sometimes there were casualties, it was very hard to keep track on, you know, which protest involved specifically, you know, blasphemy discussions or not, and also it was very hard to pinpoint the number of casualties. So we actually, you know, we have 136 incidents without all of these political protests, and believe me, there were many during the course of the 5 years. In 78 times, the state was already enforcing the law through formal proceedings, but mob violence still occurred. And in 58 times, the law was not formally enforced, but the individuals took justice into their own hands. Now, I'd like to say a few words about the victims. Who are they? Now, we tracked around half the cases, the religion or belief identity of the individual, okay, and in those cases, Muslims accounted for 56% of the persons arrested, and or punished or prosecuted, and the Shia group were the largest group among the Muslims. It's very important information because it shows that Muslims are the prime victims of these allegations, and so that this is not some form of Western agenda as sometimes it's portrayed. in the world, you know, when people say that Western states are, you know, focusing too much on blasphemy allegations, it's an expression of Islamophobia, etc. It's not true. We found through the facts that 56% of all victims are Muslims, so they are the large majority. Other groups who are frequently targeted for criminal blasphemy law enforcement are Christians, 25%, atheists, 7%, Baha'i, 7%, Hindu, 3%. But that is only what we managed to find, you know. So once again, there are many cases that I'm sure go unreported, but also the religious identity of the victims or the alleged blasphemers are not always reported in the media. So this is only through what we managed to find. What are the professions of these people? We managed to identify the professions in 61% of the cases. And the professions were very varied. However, we did notice some trends and patterns that are important. Now, often the following professions are accused. So we have lawyers, academics, religious figures, the media, artists, politicians or government officials, and human rights activists. And many of these can also be political dissidents in their own right, whether they are artists or bloggers or intellectuals or others. We also found incidents of extrajudicial violence, including torture or degrading treatment or punishment against the accused. And we found that in Pakistan, Iran, Algeria, and Egypt. I have so much more to tell you, but I hear that time is up. I have a lot to tell you on the laws, you know, the good news, the bad news, where there were repeals, where there weren't. But I wait for your questions, and hopefully you will have many. Thank you very much.
Well, I thank you, Joelle. I think that's a very good start, because it really gives us a sense of the breadth of these issues. And you can bring up those other substantive points during Q&A. I think they'll probably be of a very real interest. And we move to you, Marvi.
Thank you very much, Doug. I will begin by thanking Cato Institute for organizing this very, very important event. And a special thanks to Mustafa, who reached me out and gave me this opportunity. Thank you very much. Joelle's excellent report and her presentation has, I think, fairly explained the context of the blasphemy laws in the Muslim world. As far as Pakistan is concerned, the context, the political and the sociological context leading to the creation of blasphemy laws and the problems emerging from the way they were and are implemented, it's very, very complex scenario. And, you know, I think too many hours will be, will not be enough to describe all of them. So for this, for the sake of this presentation, I'll restrict myself to present to you how these laws are impacting citizens' fundamental rights, fundamental freedoms, especially the right to free speech, right to hold opinions and express those opinions, and exercising their freedom to religion and religious expression. More than the law itself, as Joelle has just explained, the vigilante justice has become a more serious problem, especially in Pakistan. The law, however, provides basis to such mob justice. And the state institutions keep providing fodder for their short-term strategic benefits and for the fear of uprising, of the extremist elements. Not only the state, the non-state actors like, for example, real estate mafia and other cartels, the local criminals, and now even the ordinary person on the street feels entitled to claim heroism by expressing intent to violence in the name of protecting prophet's honor. Excuse me. Blasphemy vigilantism is not only encouraged in Pakistan, it is actually celebrated. if you want to become overnight hero, the easiest way is to express your intent to kill someone, and you will become a hero. And if you actually kill someone, you are, oh God, you are a hero for all times to come. There are countless examples from the public, from recent past, of people celebrating the killer of Punjab governor who was assassinated in the name of blasphemy. The killer was celebrated. He was garlanded, and his grave is, he was handed over sentence, death sentence by the court, and it was executed. But his grave is now is a shrine, and people go there and pay their respects to a killer. And no government, no state institution would dare even condemn that. People will not call, we started calling Salman Taseer a martyr, a shaheed. And for calling that, Pakistan's sitting senator tabled a resolution in Senate of Pakistan back in 2011-2012, asking the Senate to vote for declaring me a blasphemer so that I could be put in jail and I could be hanged, executed. Of course, that sort of resolution was defeated. It was, no one wanted to vote on that. But that is part of Pakistan's parliamentary record. But that can explain how deep the problem is. The mob, ordinary people, they were celebrating Mr. Petty's murder, the French teacher who was murdered by a 18 years old youngster. Another youngster, Mishal Khan in Pakistan, who was a student at the university in Mardan, Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province, he was lynched by a mob, and it was filmed, but perpetrators were still, they roam free. Tahir Naseem, a US citizen, he was an Ahmadi. He was standing trial under blasphemy laws when he was killed inside the courtroom last year, July. His killer was also a teenager, and he also became an overnight hero. Received public accolades, garlanded, and actually his picture was circulated with my picture with a caption that her fate should be decided by a hero like this. So this is the situation of the vigilantism, the mob, rage and violence. All this while, the liberal sections of civil society just mourn the demise of the rule of law, while the judges who hand over or who even hear the cases of the under blasphemy laws, they are threatened. The lawyers are threatened. In fact, a lawyer who was a dear friend, Rashid Rehman, he was killed in Multan in the precincts of the court while sitting in his office, in his chamber, because he was hearing the case of Junaid Hafiz, a teacher, a university professor, who was accused of blasphemy, and now he has handed the death sentence last year. Politicians, law enforcement officials, human rights activists, you name it, everyone is under this constant, we live in this constant environment of fear, knowing we could be targeted next, we could be accused of blasphemy if we keep on expressing our views completely unrelated to religion, but dissenting from the accepted moral code or the policies of the state. I'll now in the end, is it my time up? No. Okay, thank you. So I will just highlight just four points here. First of all, the religious, how the religious expression and the right to religion, religious freedom is negatively impacted by the blasphemy laws. Ahmadis, Christians, Hindu minorities, all these religious minorities that live in Pakistan, plus now the sectarian minorities within the scheme of Islam, for example, Shias, they are now increasingly they are being accused of blasphemy just because their religious, you know, for example, Shias, they have, you know, in the fiqh, they have some different, you know, views and some different set of beliefs about the Islamic history after the Prophet. Now, not about some of the religious injunctions, but about the events that after the Prophet. Just because of that, they are last year over 75 Shia people were booked for. Now, this is a conservative number. The Shia community claims the number is much more than this. These are the official figures. over 75 Shia scholars were booked under blasphemy because they were delivering, we call it majlis, they were delivering sermons on the eve of the martyrdom day of Hussein, radiallahu ta'ala anhu, the grandson of the Prophet. Now, this was unprecedented. I mean, Shias have been called apostate or, you know, excommunicated from Islam because of their beliefs. But, you know, Barelvis, another sect that was considered to be closer to Shias, never did that. But now the Barelvi sect, which is, it's, you know, there is evidence floating around in Pakistan that the Barelvis, some scholars from the Barelvi sect in Pakistan are under the influence, actually under the control of the military establishment of Pakistan. So this entire thing is happening in a very, very political landscape. The second is, by the way, just yesterday, I highlighted a case on Twitter. Two Christian men were booked for blasphemy. The crime was they were reciting Bible in a quiet corner of a park in Lahore, city of Punjab province. Now, Punjab is the biggest province population-wise, and Lahore is called the heart of Punjab or heart of Pakistan. It's the most populous city of Punjab. Now, one escaped, and I just received an SMS, a text message from Pakistan that the person who escaped the scene is also arrested. Now, they don't know their fate. They were just reciting Bible. And the people around, the Muslims walking around in the park, they objected to it and said that it was a crime to preach your religion if you are not a Muslim. This describes how, I mean, this can explain, is the available religious freedom to the religious minorities and sectarian minorities within the Muslim community. The second point is the freedom of expression and political dissent, how it is curbed. Everyone who is like myself, I do not comment on religion. I'm mostly a political commentator and a human rights defender. But people like us are being accused of blasphemy on one pretext or the other, because the blasphemy has become, you know, if a state institution wants to kill you, they don't want to do it themselves. They can just outsource it by accusing you of blasphemy because the mob will do the rest. And this has happened in the past with the bloggers case in Pakistan in 2017, when four bloggers were picked up by the intelligence agency in Pakistan. And, you know, the intelligence agencies do not have arresting power, so then they just abduct because they can. And they abducted and then ran a campaign against them that they were blasphemers and they had committed blasphemy. Now, they did not even discuss religion. They were all political commentators and were critics of the military's policies. The third point is, I'll take just 30 more seconds. The third point is it is by using blasphemy laws, it is very important to understand how political process is controlled by the military establishment or the deep state. These Bareilly groups were in 2017, supported to stage a sit-in and to topple the government. And their accusation was that the government has passed some law or changed some law that was could be interpreted as being Ahmadis being acceptable. So Ahmadis being excommunicated from Islam, called apostates or whatever, it was not acceptable to anyone in Pakistan, especially these religious elements. So the sit-in was staged for several days. Islamabad, the capital city, was closed down. It was completely shut down. No business, no official work was. And at the end of it, the military general was caught on camera distributing money among the participants of this sit-in. When a judge issued a judgment on this case against the sit-in, and alluded in that in his order that military establishment might be involved in this, and it should not be acceptable under a democracy. This judge is being hounded by the state institutions and is every day is being discredited from the public eye. Our parliament is controlled through blasphemy laws. Even if you touch something, or even if you express your opinion to touch something that is not acceptable to military establishment, then that party will be accused of blasphemy. And through blasphemy laws, the entire legislative system is being controlled. Last point, academic freedom. How academic freedom of the teachers is being, a TV evangelist in 2017, he came on TV and asked all the students of Pakistan to be vigilant on the teachers and make videos of them. If some teacher says something that in their opinions is contrary to Islam, that video should be made viral and the teacher should be booked for blasphemy. Now, this happened in Junaid Hafiz's case, and this is happening. You can hear these cases from the remote areas every other day. Literally every other day. So this is how these different shades of personal freedom of the citizens are being controlled and restricted just by using blasphemy laws or blasphemy vigilantism. I'll stop here because my time ended 5 minutes ago. I think I'm so sorry for taking so much time. Thank you very much.
Well, Marvi, we want to thank you again, not only for your contribution to this forum, but what you do under such difficult circumstances, again, it's extraordinary. And for us, it's an honor to have you with us. We very much appreciate what you do on behalf of liberty and human rights in Pakistan, and it applies elsewhere in the world. It's a very important fight. So we want to conclude with Mustafa. And if you want to bring in how this might apply to Americans, some of our questions, which we'll get to, but there's an interest in how these lessons apply to the United States, Mustafa. So if you have thoughts on that, feel free to bring that in as well.
Sure. Thanks to Joelle and Marvi for joining us at this Cato Institute forum. Joelle's report has been so enlightening. I mean, not just Joelle's, but we should also, of course, be thankful to Jocelyn Getkin-Kestenbaum, if I pronounce her name right. She's not with us today, but she co-authored the report, the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom report, which I was, reading sadly. And from Marvi, we are hearing about all the concerning details of the scene in Pakistan. Now, as a Muslim who's looking into these issues, and as someone who's been thinking about issues of freedom in Islam, this makes me sad, and it shows me that we need some work to do. And I think responsible Muslim clerics, opinion leaders, political leaders, intellectuals have some work to do on this. And there are efforts, of course, for reforming blasphemy laws. A lot of scholars have written important articles. There are movements, there are calls in the Muslim world to getting away with not just blasphemy laws, but any other act of coercion in the name of Islam. That would include apostasy laws, that would include religious policing, let alone other forms of violence. Now, I'll say a few things from the Islamic point of view, Doug, if you allow me. First of all, I think we should see here that beyond religion or even beneath religion, there's something else here play, what social scientists call sometimes honor culture. It refers to a culture where one's reputation or values, religious or not, is eagerly protected by force. No wonder, you know, honor culture leads to what we can call secular blasphemy laws. My home country, Turkey, as you mentioned, is a severe case of that. Since 2014, more than 60,000 people have been prosecuted in Turkey, and thousands of them have been given prison sentences for insulting not God or the prophet, but the president. This may, in fact, be the most severe blasphemy, one of the most severe blasphemy crises in the world right now, if we define the term blasphemy a bit broadly. But besides that, besides honor culture, nationalist pride, and all those sort of things that also suppress free speech, there's clearly an issue with understanding of religion and religious values and religious law in the Muslim context. So I'll say a few things about that. And I should say that the laws in question, for example, in Pakistan, people sometimes remind that they are left over from the colonial era, which is true technically, but most of the laws are in Pakistan or some post-colonial Muslim societies are left over from that era, which is a problem in itself, a grim era in itself. But they have been strengthened and they have been made more severe and more definitive with a clearly Islamic ambition to silence blasphemy. I call Islamic, you know, relatively speaking, of course, not every Muslim would agree with that. Which should bring us to an honest discussion about blasphemy laws within Islam as a religion, within the religious law tradition in Islam, the Sharia, and its interpretation by the jurists, the fuqaha. And when we look into that, we will see a clearly grim picture, and that is medieval Islamic jurists considered blasphemy as a capital crime. That is true for the four main Sunni schools and the main Shia school, the Ja'fari school. They all consider it's a capital crime, sab Allah or sab al Rasul, which is insult of God and the Prophet. Those people who did this should be executed. They just disagreed on whether the blasphemer can repent or not. It is interesting that they were even harsher on the insult of Prophet more than God. For an interesting reasoning, they thought because God will punish a blasphemer on his own, he has his ultimate presence, but the prophet is dead and he's gone. We have to protect the prophet on his behalf after he's gone. So those medieval verdicts in Islamic jurisprudence are there. It's death penalty for blasphemers. Not all Muslims are certainly eager to implement these laws. Many Muslims are not even aware of them, but some are. These are the people that we call Islamists, and Marvi described that scene in Pakistan, how it works as a force in society that even calls on the state, and if the state even doesn't, does its own the act of punishing blasphemy through violence. So those forces are there because they are convicted that this is the Islamic thing to do. It's written in medieval jurisprudence. And a small extremist strain within that Islamist universe even believes in implementing this as terrorism in the middle of Europe, which is what we saw in France, unfortunately, in the horrific terrorist attacks there in the past decade. So I believe an honest conversation is needed. And an honest conversation to face these blasphemy laws and to repeal them is needed. And for that, it's a huge topic, which I cover in my forthcoming book, Reopening Muslim Minds. But I'll just here highlight three points. One is that I think Muslims who believe in blasphemy laws should see that these laws appeared in a historical context where everybody had blasphemy laws. I mean, by everybody, I'm referring to especially in particular to the Byzantine and Sassanid empires who had similar blasphemy laws. These were the empires that Muslims faced and partly inherited in terms of even their legal notions. when you look into Sassanid laws, for example, that ban enmity towards gods, it sounds very similar to some of the things written in the Muslim literature about blasphemy. And so therefore, when Muslims look into what's written in their jurisprudence books, they should consider that maybe they're not looking into the eternal principles of Islam, but just a bygone archaic era in human history. Second, blasphemy laws are justified through some episodes written in the biographies of the Prophet, peace be upon him, where we hear that some people insulted the Prophet or wrote satirical poets against him, and then they were executed by early Muslims. So this is taken as a precedent to establish blasphemy laws. But if you look into those stories more carefully, which I do in my forthcoming book, you see that the issue there was not mere satire or criticism or insult, but active enmity in terms of physical attacks or incitement to war, or at least violence against Muslims. Meanwhile, there are reports that Prophet actually didn't punish who insulted him, but quite the contrary, showed them grace and mercy. And I think that's probably the more universal lesson we should derive from the life of the Prophet. Third, the only undisputed source in Islam, every Muslim would agree with that, is the Quran. And when you look into the Quran on this issue, everybody can see that there is no earthly punishment in the Quran for blasphemy or apostasy, for that matter. The most relevant verse of the Quran to this issue is verse Nisa 124 or 4:124. Which I have referred to in various writings to Muslims. It says, if you hear people denying and ridiculing God's revelation, do not sit with them unless they start to talk of other things. So the verse doesn't say go and attack people if they ridicule Islam. It doesn't even say silence them. It just says do not sit with those people, which means just disengage. I think this can be very well the basis of a proper Muslim response to blasphemy in the modern world. If there are people who criticize Islam, who offend Islam, don't listen to them, don't join their events, or you know, maybe you can boycott them. You may stop buying their magazine if you're buying. But there's no justification really in the Quran for coercion, for violence, for killing people, for jailing people. So with such, I think, arguments, there needs to be a stronger push in the Muslim world. And also, I think Muslims who are eager to punish blasphemy by force should realize that they're just killing and tormenting innocent people one after another. In Pakistan, most burning case, but other places as well. And by killing and tormenting innocent people in the name of your faith, you're not bringing any honor to your faith. You're just bringing shame. So this is what I think from an Islamic point of view, and this is what I see as the Islamic antidote to the radicalism in the name of Islam, is what you see in this issue. And I think seeing what is happening on the ground should show us, to Muslims who are listening to us in Pakistan or elsewhere, how important this issue is, how much of a problem, a stain on the honor of Islam this issue is right now in the world. And here are some of the arguments that we can use to move forward. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mustafa. Very much appreciate that, all of our panelists. I was going to offer some questions, but we've had a lot of very good ones come in. I'll ask our panelists to try to give concise answers because we don't have a lot of time, but a lot of very good questions. What I'll do is I'll throw it to one or another panelist, and if you know anyone else wants to come in, you know, please just let me know. The first question I want to take is a good one from Sabiha Riemann, and I'm sorry if I've butchered your name on Twitter, asking a very simple one, please define blasphemy. So can I give that to you, Joelle? Given the study you've done, how do we define blasphemy?
Joelle, you need to turn up.
Yeah, you're on mute, Joelle.
So sorry. Apologies for that. We actually have a definition in our report. I don't know if you want me to read it out to you. I totally can. It's committing acts of violence in the name of protecting God, religion, and the sacred. We have quite a restrictive definition that you can read yourself in the report. But for example, Mustafa was speaking about, you know, this secular blasphemy law in Turkey, where the insult of the president can create so much criminalization and so many arrests. And for example, you know, you have the same thing in Thailand, where if you insult the king or the royal family, you can also be prosecuted. Now, all these forms of blasphemy, we actually took away. So we're only dealing with insult of the God and the sacred. You can find our definition in the report itself. But it's really just linked to God and the sacred.
Well, thank you. I have a question. Let me give this one to Mustafa. I'm going to combine a couple of questions. One is from Roger Trigg and another one is anonymous. But basically the question of how do we balance the issue of free speech, and do we want to put any restraints at all in terms of people's ability to insult, you know, one's faith, to make false statements, to, you know, make kind of charges that both offend people and might be disruptive, might, you know, encourage violence. How do we, you know, kind of balance that? Is it an absolute right or should there be restrictions? And we've had a couple of questions on this.
Well, I mean, this is a very good question. And I think this is a question for not just Muslims, but anybody, of course, any country and any civilization. And I think there are better criteria in the world established. I think U.S. First Amendment principles and the laws built upon them and the Supreme Court decisions have established a good principle. That is, incitement to violence is a crime, but offense, insult, is not. And I think that is the right standard, because if you say, well, a certain kind of insult should be a crime, where do you stop that? Because insult is very much a matter of perception. I mean, Marvi pointed out to a very good example. If you're a Christian and if you read the Bible in the middle of a Pakistani city, some things in the Bible where, for example, I mean, the New Testament, where Jesus is, for example, defined as divine son of God, will sound offensive to Muslims. They will say, oh my God, this is a heretical speech. This is actually insulting our religion. Even forget that. Think of Shia versus Sunni. As Marvi again reminded, Shia Muslims are being persecuted and targeted in Pakistan in the name of blasphemy laws, because some of the things that Shia Muslims believe about early Islam, about the companions of the Prophet, are blasphemous from a Sunni point of view. And if you take those Sunnis and, you know, some things they will say will be blasphemous in a Shia environment. So there is no end to trying to manage the sensibilities. And I'm not saying this as someone who thinks that people should blaspheme and it's a good thing. No, I think for social harmony, it's good if people are careful in their language in a respectful way. And I think that's a more constructive approach to society. But if you start to criminalize this, it might come to Pakistani levels, I mean, which are very concerning. Therefore, I also, one more thing, to move forward within the Muslim world on these issues, one thing that has to be done is to be in the Western world more principled on those issues. I generally appreciate the U.S. standards on free speech, but regarding France, when I've written recently an article which touches upon this, it's an insult in France to it's a crime in France to insult the flag or the national anthem. And typically, Muslims who defend blasphemy laws show these things, saying that, you see, actually, you have these laws in Western societies. So I think we should raise the level of free speech within Western societies. And I think probably U.S. standards are not bad. But in Europe, maybe we need to hire free speech. So we can make the same argument on the same principle. And one thing here is that you cannot tell to people that, you know, religious sensibilities can be insulted. It's not a big deal. But national sensibilities cannot be. No, that's not going to work. People have different sacrednesses, and you cannot ask them to give up one while protecting the other one. So that's what I can say on that question. Hope this makes sense.
Well, thank you. Marvi, would you like to get in on this, your short comment?
Yeah, I think basically I'm just uncomfortable with the concept of blasphemy. As Mustafa already said, it's quite subjective. Insult to religion or insult to any holy personage or a sacred text is it's a matter of disagreement. It's a matter of very personal kind of interpretations and very personal kind of concept of what do you consider insult. And I think if religion is, if the divinity is being insulted, don't you think divinity is powerful enough to protect itself? And I think the blasphemers are the people who think they can protect the honor of the prophet. I mean, a prophet doesn't depend on you. Divinity does not depend on you to protect itself. So my view is quite dispassionate about this. If your sensibilities are hurt that easily, it means that you need to do something about your sensibilities rather than killing people around.
Joelle, would you like to say something as well?
With everything that was said, everybody, I can. Oh, goodness.
You're okay now.
Can you hear me now?
Hear you.
Wonderful. Yes. No, of course, I agree with everything that was said, obviously. You know, I could say exactly the same thing to Doug, Mustafa, and Marvi. And the three of them on this panel will be differently insulted. They will be insulted. One might not feel at all insulted. One might feel very insulted. One might feel, indifferent. So it's just, I think what it's important to also remember that debate allows a society to breathe intellectually, that many intellectuals, when they start challenging ideas in the world, and we can also of course refer to religious figures as well, many are are against the mainstream thinking. And so for a society to breathe intellectually, to breathe culturally, to thrive democratically, it's important to have a bit of resilience and to be able to not, of course, suffer from incitement to hatred or incitement to violence, but just feel sometimes a bit offended, because it sharpens your arguments as well in a society. So from an intellectual point of view and a religious point of view, sometimes the mainstream is often contested at first.
I'm so sorry. We have so many good questions and we're running out of time. We're down to about 5 minutes left. Feminists for Liberty on Twitter asks, to what degree do these anti-blasphemy laws overlap with gender-based violence? And is there are there different prosecution rates? Is there, how does this come together? So if I can go to you, Joelle first and then to Marvi.
Sure. Actually, one of the questions that we were wondering was, were males or females accused more frequently of blasphemy? And we were actually quite surprised, because 84% of the victims that we covered are male, which makes, 16% being female. So we were actually, it was a finding. Maybe it would be more interesting to delve into this. Is it because, men in society are more visible? But of course, this doesn't, exclude many different women who have been at the forefront of blasphemy allegations. I think of Asia Bibi in Pakistan and many others. Women have suffered as well. But according to our statistics, the larger majority are male.
Just to a couple of minutes.
Should I go ahead?
Yes, please.
Yeah, so I would agree with Joel, you know, in the specific context of Pakistan, for example, it is claimed by the larger society that being an Eastern and being an Islamic society, we are more respectful towards women. Although the practice says otherwise, but this is at least claimed. And, you know, I would agree with what Joel said. If we look at the cases of blasphemy accusations, there are not many as compared to the men. Asya Bibi was a shocker. I mean, Asya Bibi actually shocked us all. A woman handed over death sentence. I mean, she was accused, and then a local court actually sentenced her to death, and that was a big shock in Pakistani society. But now it is even this is getting common. You know, the other day Mustafa mentioned a case of a woman nurse. Who was accused of blasphemy and who was being beaten up by another woman. So if there is a gender, I think there's a class dimension to it more than gender dimension. If you look at the cases of the blasphemy accused, I don't have exact numbers, but I can say that 80 to 90% would be from the lower middle classes, the lower classes. So that the religious minorities, I mean, not only the Muslim, non-Muslim minority, but the, you know, within Islam, Shias, Ahmadis, even in some cases, Barelvis, etc. And most of them are men.
And Mustafa, we have just a couple minutes left. Let me ask you a question that's come in from Kat on Twitter. Can you compare and contrast laws that enforce religion, such as anti-blasphemy laws, with laws that limit religion, such as the French hijab bans or Chinese anti-Uyghur genocide? Could you tie those to, again, just a couple of minutes left. I wish we had more time.
Well, they are all intrusions in individual lives and or the expressions of individuals. Of course, France is a liberal democracy. I cannot compare. But I have been critical of some of the illiberal laws in France, including the hijab, which is the headscarf ban. I think forcing a Muslim woman to put on a headscarf, as they do it in Iran or Saudi Arabia, is very authoritarian and unacceptable. Forcing a woman to take it off, not in the streets in France, but in schools or in public offices, if they are a government official, that's wrong as well. And there are now people in France for calling for broader, you know, headscarf ban, which would be unacceptable. That's why I'm saying to help advance freedom in countries that have very low levels of freedom, we should raise the bar in the Western society as well. And France would be an example there. China is a whole different story. That's a totalitarian regime. I mean, and I think the campaign against Uyghurs is can be called genocide now because of all the forced sterilizations and abortions. But China shows that when offensive speech, I mean, Muslims are also being prosecuted for offensive speech, whatever they say publicly about their religion, which offends the Communist Party of China. So, which is a lesson for Muslims to think that, well, if we think that offensive words, speeches, world values should be punished by us, when we have the majority, think what happens when we are a minority repressed by an authoritarian majority. So I think there is a good lesson there to defend freedom everywhere, whether you're a minority, which is suffering from authoritarianism, or whether you're a majority, which thinks authoritarianism is fine.
Well, I thank you so much. As I indicated, we have an enormous number of very good questions here. I want to point out again that Joel's report is on the Cato website. You can also get it. I want to recognize the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. They had a hearing on this topic back in December. I think it was December 9. Joelle spoke at that, as well as her co-author and a number of other activists and analysts. You know, I recommend that as well if you're interested in this. I want to thank everyone who's come to watch this. It really is a very important topic. Very much thank our panelists. I think an extraordinary group of people who've done incredible work on this. And I want to thank, as any of these, we have people behind the scenes who actually make it all happen. Kiana Graham and David Tassi have been very active, sending me messages and making sure that the program has gone on. And of course, we have our conference department and others who've also been very helpful. They really make this stuff go. We're just the front people for it. The video has been recorded. It'll be edited a little and put up on the site either by late today or tomorrow. So if you want to watch it again, or if you want to recommend it to somebody, we certainly wish you would do so. So again, I want to thank you all and wish you a very good day.